Thanks for staying. Awesome. I honestly thought there'd be like three people left in a room and it would be us up here.
No, I came especially to you.
Yeah, see, I like that. See, now I'm motivated. I was getting tired. Okay. Yeah. So I should say, so I'm currently at Berkeley, doing my work at Berkeley. And this research is actually done back my hometown outside of Pittsburgh. And so this is the public housing, intergenerational photo voice perspectives on place, health, and opportunity, the structure struggle. No disclosures. So a little overview of what I'm going to talk about. Give a little background on placemaking and health and public housing. Then I'll get into a little bit of place health research and this notion of the placescape. And then I'll get into the photo voice project specifically and give a little background over the overview of the overall research project that the photo voice was done in, and then get into the findings. I think for me, I'm really most excited about that. So I'll try to move quickly, get it all out there. So quite simply, place matters for health. This is not a new thing. I think on our panel today, you've already seen quite a bit of how place matters. And it's independently of individual characteristics. So over and beyond what an individual does or does not do for individual selves, there are things outside of their control, things in the social environment, physical environment, political environment, that fundamentally alter how healthy they can be. We've seen this for outcomes from heart disease to diabetes, celebrated health, and this field is growing rapidly. Like, I think that, you know, back in the 80s there was some work, but in the last 10, 15 years, there's not only complete volumes of journals dedicated just for place and health, but now there are like multiple books being published every year on neighborhood effects and health. So it's growing very rapidly. And with this understanding, we're starting to understand that if we want to have health interventions, there's implications for local policies now. At a population level, all the information to be used to develop policies, but now we have very specific local, social, physical, environmental effects that we're seeing. It has implications more locally, so you can have direct action. And because of that, we're seeing a lot of movement towards place-based solutions, and it was cool that, you know, the Best Baby Zone is just another example of that. So there's more initiatives like that growing. I think one of the more prominent ones we've seen in recent years is the Harlem Children's Zone in New York. There's also another major one in California through the California Endowment called Building Healthy Communities, and there's a national one through the National Collaborative for Health Equity called Place Matters. But outside of that, the largest ones we're seeing in the country historically and currently are actually through public housing. So for example, Choice Neighborhoods, which was formerly or kind of an extension or the re-evolution of Hope 6 public housing communities, and then Sustainable Communities, which takes choice to the next level, makes it more regional, and builds in other aspects of it, so it's transportation and an environmental, like EPA and everything like that. And then Promise Zones, which is actually modeled after the Harlem Children's Zone. And then outside of those ones that are explicitly public housing related, there's also these placemaking mechanisms that are the largest source in terms of, if you think about the size of place-based strategies, you think about funding, you think about spatial area, and you think about the number of people affected. What you see on the screen here now between Choice, Hope 6, Sustainable Communities, Promise Zones, and then you also have things like the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, the Home Investment Partnership Program, and Community Development Block Grant. These are the largest place-making strategies that we have currently in this country. And so for me, thinking about this in the context of public housing, we see that health of public housing residents is actually some of the worst documented in the U.S. From self-reported health status to hypertension, all the way down to mortality rates, you see that a lot of these indicators, they're 3 to 4 times worse in the population. Even when you compare public housing residents to other poor communities that aren't public housing, they still tend to be 2 to 3 times worse on those health indicators. But unfortunately, there's actually a pretty significant lack of research on health within public housing communities. And for me, I found this very intriguing. As a former resident of public housing, which is part of my motivation to get into this field of work, is that we think about the life course that someone mentioned earlier. A lot of public housing communities are like one of these, from a research perspective, a change perspective, one of these ideal settings to do life course-oriented, long-term public health place-based research. Public housing communities tend to be very specific localities, less than 40% of the residents are less than 18. There's a high percentage of multi-generational households, so you have a grandparent and a parent and the children. And residents tend to stay for quite a long period of time, over 5 years for most of them. So with this in mind, I started to try to develop an approach to doing place-based research, particularly within the context of public housing, that would kind of get at some of these limitations that we see in a lot of place health research, specifically this idea that most place-based research is only looking at one particular area, their area of residence and only their residential census tract. I'm just curious if anybody right now knows the census tract that they live in. Anybody? No? Didn't think so. So for my thing was that we don't really live in census tracts. We don't. They're imaginary lines. We don't live in zip codes either. They're imaginary lines. They're administrative lines. Place is not experienced by a definition for administrative boundaries. Place is experienced visually, experientially, where we go throughout our day. So the placegate model really tries to account for this multinodal notion of place in the contingent spatial, temporal, and social connections and divisions between those places. So where do people actually go and spend their time? Why do they go to these places, and why don't they go to other places? The place that we go to are just as important as the place that we don't go to or that we can't go to. So we need to account for that. If we're going place and health, then we actually have to do a better idea of understanding what place is. And this model also tries to account for the idea that there's going to be differences between how young people and older people perceive their place and experience their place. So we have to account for intergenerational and life space differences in place experience and perceptions. And then on top of that, we have to understand that place doesn't just fall from the sky. It's made, it's unmade, it's remade. Just as much as we're place-making, we're place-breaking as well, a lot of our policies. So any approach to place, understanding place and its health effects has to be situated within the social, economic, political context of how these places are made and remade over time. So with that kind of framework, I developed the People's Social Upbeat Project, and within there is where the Photo Voices activities took place. So a quick background for our Social Epi Project. It's a community-based research study of place and health. It involved recruitment of parent-youth dyads. We started with 8 parents and 9 youth. We finished with complete data from 4 parents and 7 youth. The youth had to be residing with the parent who was participating. And in terms of inclusion and exclusion, the youth had to be enrolled in school. Because again, we're getting this multinodal place, and so school is a very important place for young people, so they had to have a place of education. And then for adults, they had to have some type of non-leisure fixed daily activity. So formal employment, informal employment, or running errands or something of that nature, so that there wasn't just one place within the study, but they had multiple places to engage within the research. And participants were paid. I made it the very key point that it's participatory action research at CBPR. I wasn't getting paid for it. It's part of my dissertation work, but I felt like eventually we're all professionals. We get paid for doing this. Why shouldn't they? Especially for social epidemiology, we're studying social inequalities, and we're getting paid to do it. So for me, it was very critical that they actually receive some type of stipend to participate in this work. So the project aims overall, one, was basically just determining where they go. Let's map out these places, where they go in their daily lives. And within 5 place domains, home, neighborhood, work and errand for parents and school for the youth, leisure, social, and transition, which is basically just the spaces and the routes they go through to get to a certain place. Second was to, once they map out and identify the places they go to on a daily or weekly basis, characterize their perceptions and experiences within those places. And then third, to assess the spatial and temporal differences between youth and adults and the perceptual differences. So what do youth think about a particular place, and how do the adults actually see it? So we have an intergenerational perspective on place. So quickly through the methods, they receive some basic training on public health and basic research, social epidemiology, some basic concepts. They were trained in photo voice, activity-based mapping, x-ray mapping, and participatory GIS. For here, I'm going to go into those. The key here is for photo voice and also the participatory GIS, so I'll just get right into that. So a little bit of background on photo voice. Anybody familiar? Photo voice? Oh, I love it. This is awesome. So I guess I should skip. It's on the slides now, but I could just skip and we can go to the real stuff, but I guess okay. So it's the participatory action research methodology that's designed to facilitate participants through photography, the visual methodology. It's premised on 3 core goals. Basically to enable people to record and reflect their community strengths and concerns, promote critical dialogue, and to reach policymakers. So you're doing it with the intention as a new way to actively promote the voice of participants in the research with the end goal that you're not doing it just to publish an article. It's not about publications, it's about public action, right? That's one of the methodologies really focused on that. So essentially what participants did was they take photos in a social documentary style, and then they narrate them with guidance from a facilitator, identify themes, and then go towards action. This table right here is just kind of like a more enumerated list of like a process. For here, the first item and the second item about having a target audience, I actually met with the mayor, the city planner, city manager, health commissioner, 2 city council members, and the school board all while I was recruiting to make sure that there was an opportunity for the participants to share their work, and also because I'm trying to turn a methodology into a high school STEM course to be implemented at the public high school. So I was doing all this stuff simultaneously. So regardless of what the research found and whether it gets published, that there is actually something to be coming out of the project. In terms of the third step, definitely do the training. And there was specific consent for this methodology, and then there's also consent and assent for the overall project. So they actually had a very method-specific consent for this because the visual methodology sometimes a little bit more privacy concerns a little bit greater. In terms of 6 and 7, they used their smartphones, so there was no passing out cameras. This 2015, even though it's public housing, a lot of residents don't have smartphones. Data plans can be an issue, but they have a phone at least. So they used their smartphones, and there wasn't a provision. A lot of traditional photo booth projects, they give them a specific time. They go out for an hour and they come back. This was like, basically, we want to know where you go, how you experience the place about through your daily life. So they just walk around, about going to school, going to work, going to a friend's house. If they saw something they thought was important, pull it off the phone, take a picture. Cool, all right. So basically, a little illustration of what they did. First, they take a picture. This is the school lunch. They write a narrative about what they think about it, like, this is awesome, I love styrofoam, this is the most amazing meal ever. And then they would map it out on a printed map through activity-based mapping. So they would identify the location, and that's the high school. And then they would create an account on a web-based mapping platform called Local Ground. And through here, you can see some of the options here. You can create multiple maps and share them very easily, right? So they would take their picture, and they would upload it, and they would geolocate it visually through this platform. And basically, you create an account like it's an email. For the review process, there were 3 to 4 photo review sessions. The final session, they selected their favorite photos, the final 5, framed them, and they completed this photo voice narrative that you guys are mostly probably familiar with. And so based on those photos and these narratives is where we got out most of the data from. In terms of the participatory analysis, I think it's common for a qualitative work that the researcher analyzes it. For me, I just felt like that was another level that I was taking power and agency away from the participants, so I trained them how to do participatory analysis. So it was very interesting because, they're teenagers and adults that had never done research before, but it was very much worth it, trust me, it was worth it. So this is what it consisted of. So they got their frame photos, they sorted them and grouped them based on how they thought they belonged together, just kind of get the thematic groupings, right, basic. And then they reviewed each other's coded narratives, right? So I typed them all up, printed them out, and handed them to the groups. And adults and youth did this in 7 groups. So they went through each other's narratives, and they coded them themselves. And the way they did this, that they gave them the typed copy, and it was like each youth had all the other youths written out scripts, and the adults had the same thing. And they would go through it with a highlighter individually and highlight the things that they thought were important. And then they got together as a group collectively to look at each other's highlights and see who highlighted what. And they would count each unique coding to see how many unique codes there were for each photo. And then they would use color-coded highlights, green for positive and pink for negative, to indicate whether each of those unique codings was a good thing or a bad thing. And then they were tabulated, and then that gave them an opportunity to revise their photo grouping. So they grouped them pictures by themselves. And then they did the narrative analysis, and then after the narrative analysis, sometimes they're like, oh, well, actually, now that I've seen the narrative, this picture makes more sense in this group. So these are just some pictures of what it would look like. So you see on the left there, that was their participatory coding analysis there, and on the left is how they voted for the groups. The blue group, the blue stickers represent their priority for that photo group, that thematic group, and the yellow stickers represent a particular photo or theme or code within that group that they thought was most important. And you see how they kind of rearrange group 4 photo down to the group 6. Okay, these are just the tables showing the coding results. I won't go into this, not very exciting. I think that the big thing to point out here is that the top tables, the youth identify vacant buildings as a prominent thematic group, positive buildings as a prominent group, and also empty space, which mostly consisted of vacant lots or parking lots. And the adults in the bottom, a group they identified named it Room to Grow, and then another group called Housing. Something that kind of stood out was that both youth and adults had about 70% of their codings were in pink. So not a whole lot of like green codings about their places they're identifying. Another way to look at this within the place domains for this project, again, home, neighborhood, school, leisure, and transition. You can see that the first column on the top again for the youth, that most of their pictures were for the neighborhood domain, and also same for the parents. And then the second behind it was the home place domain. And here you can see, similar to the last one, that most of their ratings were in terms of whether the places were bad, positive, healthy, unhealthy, negative, etc. Most of them actually end up being negative again. However, I should point out that the group that the youth identified as the most important was the positive buildings. So the adults were mostly concerned about their home environment. There's a lot of things wrong with the public housing community itself, and they wanted to focus on that, and that was their number one concern. But the youth were actually, you know what, we have a lot of good things, let's make them better. So even though most of their individual codings and photos were of what they would consider, what they categorize as negative, they actually chose to focus on the positive things. So this is what it looks like on the Local Ground platform. The polygon outline you see there is their residential census tract. Again, nobody really knows what that number is. None of the youth knew what that was. I offered them $100. If someone knew what that, I'm lying. I'm completely lying. But I'm saying, had I done that, they still wouldn't know what their census tract was, right? It basically just shows like the illustration of their census tract bounds. And you can see, actually, it's kind of hard to tell. This little black marker here, that's the public housing community. And you can see there's a cluster of photos within the immediate surrounding community. And you cross the little highway here, it's where some of their friends lived and where they caught the bus. And then there's a little shopping plaza right outside their census tract boundary. And then there's a couple of places that they frequented down here. This is their middle school. For the parents, you see that they're a little bit spatially kind of similar, but a little bit different. You see most of them was outside with this little strip right here where they had some friends. Another way to visualize this, putting in a topography in their positive and negative assessments, you can see that experientially speaking, their census tract has no bearing on the quality of their life. So if I'm going on a traditional place health study and I'm thinking about their well-being and throwing it into my model based on what's going on in their census tract, I misspecified pretty much as I possibly could. I would have a completely misspecified place effect for this population. Particularly because this spatially has no bearing on what's going on. But outside of that, you can see most of their negative experiences are inside this census tract boundary, and most of their positive ones are outside. So my statistical model, on traditional methods, would have completely missed that. And you can see that's just true for the adults and the parents. And I think that having a topography makes it very visually clear that when we think about place, we actually have to contextualize place and be more real and legit and ground truth than what we're actually talking about. These resonances never go up here. Why are we still analyzing that data for this population within our place health research, right? Now, of course, this doesn't undermine the value of like census tracts. There's a very good reason we use census tracts in research, right? And I still use that. So I'm out here. It sounds like I'm hating on census tracts, but I'm not. I'm just saying. But then, particular place health research, there's definitely different ways we can improve what we're doing. So here's just an example of one particular photo. So within this Local Ground platform, again, they can map it out. They upload a photo and upload their narratives here, and they can actually upload multiple photos for each place, and so you can actually scroll through it interactively. So it's an example from one of the pictures that you took of their high school. And here's just an example of one of the pictures that adults took for the housing community. So again, the youth chose to focus on their priority area was the positive buildings, and their high school was one of the positive buildings, right? They say good things about the high school, and at the end, this participant was like, yeah, but the school one's just kind of, you know, styrofoam plates and all that. And the adults, they chose to prioritize their home environment. And this is one of those photos that captures that aspect. So, future direction. I think at the top, what I was really trying to touch on is that public housing communities tend to be the largest part of place-based strategies, by space-wise, by population-wise, by money-wise. But it's a severe lack of public health research on these populations. In addition to that, if we're doing place health research within these populations, there's some serious limitations within the traditional methods we usually use to do place health research. And so I think developing a place state concept for me and applying it to this population was a way that I think that we could kind of move the place health research field forward and also move the place-based public housing strategy go forward with a different way to frame how to assess resident well-being going forward. In terms of next steps, I really do think this methodology could complement existing other metrics. So for example, the geography of opportunity concept and the child opportunity index that's out there. I think it could be really interesting to put some qualitative work in addition to the quantitative metrics that are usually used. I think the same goes for using this type of approach for participatory planning and community health assessment within public housing communities and other place-based strategies, specifically examining results like this and methods like this in relation to the standard HUD housing inspection scores, which tend to be focused mostly just on the physical quality of buildings. And then also there's a recent tool that was recently developed, not really fully released yet, but the Health and Community Assessment Tool. I think it could also complement that. And I think I'm really interested in looking at doing this work again in other public housing communities, expanding it, really refining the PlaceGate concept, continuing to use photo voice, but then also bringing in objective assessments of place and place embodiment. So getting at the quantitative and the qualitative assessment with you know, more quantitative data and also biometrics. And that's all. So questions?
Or not? No? You chose the audience. I'm wondering what the response was, what the photos were shown.
What was that?
When the photos were shown to the audience.
Oh, so we're still planning that now. Yes. The idea is to have one at the housing community. So most of the meetings took place at the rec center right outside the public housing community. And then we're trying to get another one at the health department and city council chamber. We've had some issues with the relatively new health commissioner. And it's one of those things where it's kind of a bit of a dance to actually get them to embrace fully now that it's actually done. Yes, so fortunately, now, I guess, maybe unfortunately before, I actually grew up in that same community. So I grew up there, went to high school there, and actually trained the research co-lead and was actually a friend of my older brother. And so she had three sons, and I actually trained her to be the co-researcher, got her city certified and trained so she could actually work with human subjects research and everything. And so I think that for me, part of my motivation in doing the work that I do is because I've experienced a lot of these things we talk about in social media quite a bit, and I just haven't been a fan of the ways that we go about solving them, solving some of the issues. And so for me, I think I had the opportunity now that I'm at Berkeley doing all these things that why not actually go back to where that shaped my perspective, and why not make it so that I'm not the only one that's come from those projects to go on and be the researcher. And so I think that me going back there, I kind of already had some automatic rapport, and I think they could see someone that looked like them that was doing those things. So I think it had that put me in a position. I think some of the speakers also touched on that building those relationships and that trust for CBPR, it takes time. And which is why I'm kind of cruising to the finish line of my program now. It takes time. Even though I'm from that community, it still took time to reestablish. I think that was what mostly facilitated the process, though. Yes, in the back on the right?
Your presentation, you dealt with high school students?
Yes. There were two, so ages 13 and 18, I think there were two middle school students.
And you set the project up yourself, correct?
Yes.
And were they compensated any kind?
Yes, they were paid, the adults and the youth were paid, and then the research co-lead, she was paid even more on top of that. So I mentioned at the top, I'm from a community that's usually researched, and people publish and they benefit, they get promotions, they get tenure, they get more grants and all that, they go to conferences, and I just felt like I'm not going to reproduce that model. So I made sure that they were paid.
Yeah, I'm from Los Angeles, California, and we did a project with Sylvester Jones, Health Gas Commission. It's been about 5 years, and we did photo voice. We had three working groups, and one of them was a photo voice group. And they had cameras, and they went to their environment where they were, and they shot pictures of whatever, and then they showed it at an art festival. And I was sitting here, so I didn't want to bring that up because it took me another day to tell that they have every year in February. And they were very, they came to see it. Since it was over 3 days, they came to see it. They were just really amazed because they did the graffiti, they did this, they did that, and they told where those areas were.
Yeah.
And then some went into the exclusive area and took pictures of the walls and the this and the that and whatever and showed the difference and all that.
Yeah.
And it was a good project. But it was very interesting how people perceived what they saw, because they had to talk about what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing how they thought, oh, it looked like this, and it really wasn't that, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, and so you've given them feedback on what you've done?
Yes, so I've had, because it's like Pittsburgh, flying back and forth, I've been able to go back about twice per year to do follow-up. So we're actually still trying to finalize the exhibit and get that going, but then also going back and showing them the finished photos and everything like that. I've done that with the youth. I haven't had a chance to do it with the parents. It's a lot harder to get the parents together as a group. But I do think that I'm looking forward to that moment when they can tell that story, and I'm actually trying to prepare another opportunity like abstract so that the next time that I can have one of the youth actually join me at one of the conferences so that they can actually give the presentation. So that's the next step in terms of like sharing the photos and their narratives. Yeah. Right next. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So, again, fortunately and unfortunately, there was no geotagging on this. Because it's, IRB is really sensitive on vulnerable populations for very good reason, right? I think we all know some good reasons IRB is like that. Public housing community, very low income, mostly African American community, and youth involved. For me, when I was going to IRB, I didn't know that the geotagging was not going to fly very well within that setting, and so there was no geotagging within this project. So what they did was would take the pictures, and then they would map them out physically on a map before they took the picture, and then they would digitally map it on the platform. And there was no, so they could enter the address if they knew the address. If they didn't, they would just like zoom in and drag and drop the photo where they took it at. And so for me, I think that I use a lot of GIS a lot, and you can do some very, very robust, statistical, 100% precise things with that. This platform is not one of those things. It was mostly for the historic nature, the bigger picture, not for any like type of spatial cluster analysis. And so the exact location wasn't as important. But I do think that future work with the geotagging automatically would be a great step if the IRB allows it.
Yeah. Time for one more.
I guess one more question if there is. Yes, right here.
Hi. Did you sort of, if you had your
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm glad you asked. So when I set up this project, part of it, again, I'm in... falling down. So, you know, I'm obviously interested in research, but I'm actually more interested in research translation. There's no point in doing the research if I'm not going to translate it. So I think for me, my motivation from the very beginning was to make sure this wasn't just a research project. And so one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is translating this research project, the People Social Study Project, into a STEM curriculum that's going to be offered next fall at the high school they go to. So every student that goes to that school can actually enroll in a course based on a methodology and take that for credit, and it's going to be part of a public health pipeline program. The other thing I'm working on right now is actually the conversations with the city agencies to actually use the work that they've used for this project and for the STEM course, their activities, to actually build that into everyday public health city planning practice. And so instead of having only administrators go on data work, you actually have community-driven public health practice, community-driven city planning assessment. And so that's like the vision that I have for it. That way, the way I see it, I envision this, and I hope I'm not giving away copyright ideas or anything, but basically like a public health version of Yelp. Like public Yelp or public health or some, I don't know, some crazy cool creative thing, like an app that basically allows everyday residents to have some type of guided structure to do it within the school setting, but then also community residents to actually actively contribute to their place making and place assessment practice, right? So that's kind of what I hope to see within the next 2 or 3 years. Like I mentioned, next fall the STEM course will be active, and then hopefully, like sequentially after that, well, there'll be some opportunities to build this into local practice.
That's super inspiring, and just a suggestion that into your presentation, even your opening frame.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. We have a